to slam the door in your face.
Yeah, well. All right.
So, we got Europe suddenly having a new attitude on things. Beginning in the 16th century, the age of exploration as we know, the Europeans went out and abroad, and like the Spanish conquered the New World, and the Portuguese tried taking control of the trade routes in the Asian trade network, and eventually they would make landfall and take over a little bit, and then the Dutch would come and they would take over a little more, and the British would come and take over a little more, and all of the intellectuals in Europe was trying to figure out, how are we able to do it? And ultimately, they came to the determination that they must be superior, and all of the people that they conquered must be inferior. Why? Well, because they win. So, they were motivated to fuel their industrial revolutions, to fuel their economies, to basically get more, more, more. But this, of course, made them ferocious, because they basically believed that no one could stand in their way, that no one could stop them, that they essentially could, in fact, take over the world. And that's what they would set out to do. And of course, as they do this, they clash with existing cultures. In Africa, out of all of the regions, they would have the least resistance. Because in Africa, there was no powerful pre-existing empire or civilization. There was no Mughals. There was no China. So it was easier for them to get in. But the continent was huge. But in spite of that, they carved it up really damn quick. This map, all of these colorations, shows roughly where the Europeans were in 1880. But fast forward to 1913, and the whole continent's gone. Most of it was still unclaimed, all conquered. All carved up, all divided. Let's see. The pink is the British, the dark blue is France, the darker green is Portugal. This mud green, that's Spain. The gray is German, Belgium, etc. Carved it all up. Why? Raw materials. That was honestly the biggest reason. They were looking for rubber. They were looking for gold. Gems, of course. But they were looking for other commodities. Fuel their industrial process. Plus, if they didn't take it, someone else would. So you're engaged in this competition against your other powers. You better get it first. And they rationalized it. They said exactly what they were doing was fine. In 1890-ish or so, Rudyard Kipling wrote a pamphlet slash poem called White Man's Burden, in which he literally argued through altruism, like Herbert Spencer, that Europeans, because they were so advanced, because they were Christians, they had a duty to bring civilization to these primitive peoples and to govern them, because they were so primitive they couldn't govern themselves. Don't say that they had been doing it for 100 years prior to the arrival of the Europeans, but we won't talk about that. But what lens are they looking through? The European perspective. So, did they have parliament? Did they have elections? Did they have separation of powers? Did they have industry? No. But they lived, and they were fine. But because the Europeans were so far advanced, let's bring them into the modern world, even if it means forcing them at gunpoint. Now, prior to this age of new imperialism, going back to what we talked about, beginning with the Portuguese, the Europeans never made any type of inroads into the continent. And in fact, as late as the 1820s, it was referred to as the Dark Continent. Because while they figured out the outer perimeter and they could figure out where the major rivers were, they had no idea what was in the interior. The Portuguese and the Dutch, they set up some factories along the coast. They made trade relations with the powerful African chieftains. But they didn't go into the interior. For what? Malaria? To get bit by poisonous bugs or eaten by wild animals? No, what the African chieftains would do, the chieftains would go in and get whatever they wanted and would bring it to the Europeans. But business was impacted with the decline of the slave trade in the 19th century. So, in and around 1840, there's actually stories in European newspapers basically saying, why are we wasting our money on Africa? You know, we should close down our trading posts. There's no reason for us to be there. There's nothing of value. Well, that was until diamonds were found, and gold was found, and ivory. And then with the Industrial Revolution, rubber. So by the 1870s, even though it began to subside and it looked like they were going to let it go, boom, suddenly interest picks up again. And by this point, all of the great powers almost jumped in simultaneously. So much so, there was actually fear that they would go to war. The European powers would bump into one another in Africa and begin a war in Africa that would spread to Europe. So you're never going to believe what the Europeans did. In true European style, they decided to hold a conference. Diplomats from the 14 powers. Not that you need to remember them, because I'm going to say them real quick, and you're probably not going to be able to write any of them down anyways. Germany, Austria, Russia, Britain, France, Belgium, Denmark, Spain, America, Italy, Netherlands, Portugal, Sweden, and the Ottoman Empire. 14 of the big powers. They gather in Berlin. They're diplomats. And they sit down and they discuss, how are we going to carve up Africa in a way that doesn't result in us having a war? This literally is a cartoon that was printed in the newspapers. Look, there's Africa right there. Let's cut it up nice and evenly. Well, they agreed to rules that they would follow. Oh, by the way, you know who was not invited to the conference? No, America was there. What part of the world are they carving up? Who was not asked if they were interested in getting carved up?
Africa.
Africa. So what would they do? This says occupation. They would basically form a 14-nation pact, an agreement, called the Principle of Effective Occupation. These are the rules that all of the powers agreed to in order to avoid war in Africa over Africa. nations would occupy land when they had possession. So if they could show that they actually had boots on the ground, not necessarily soldiers, they could have been salesmen, they could be ambassadors, could be soldiers, anybody, anyone from their country. If they could show that they were actually there in possession of the land. Two, they had to prove that they made treaties with the local leaders. So one, they had possession. Two, they had treaties. But of course, how many of the African chieftains do you think spoke French or German or Italian? You think they actually knew what they were signing up for? No. But the Europeans, oh, we had to have a piece of paper. Three, they had to have the ability to fly their flag there. So if they had a building and they could put their flag on it and nobody locally came and took it down, that was proof that they had permission to be there. So we got possession, treaties, flag. Last but not least, the fourth. They had to have some type of power over the land. So they either had to administer it, they had to be in charge of it, or they had to have the right to police it. So they could have their soldiers walking around on the streets without being attacked by the natives. If they had those four things, no other nation could come in and claim it for their own. Now, ironically, to go back to this one, once they had the treaty, because look how integrated all the different colors are, that's how this mess ended up being like this. Because you know what they began doing? They began trading with one another. Okay, you got this territory over here, but I want that territory over there. So let's trade. Like Pokemon cards, if you guys were into that when you were kids. And again, I just want to reiterate the simple truism. The Africans were never asked. So it was possible that a village in a span of 30 years could be held by the Portuguese, the Belgians, the Germans, and then the Dutch. Because they would just trade it. But at least the Europeans didn't fight one another over it. And by the way, these rules would remain in place all the way up until World War I. And even at the beginning of the World War, beginning of the First World War, the Germans pledged they would not violate that agreement. And they would not attack French colonies or British colonies, even though in Europe they were fighting against one another. But you know who broke the damn agreement? The British. All right, questions on that? Now, it's not possible for us to even remotely come close to covering every single last acre in Africa and how it was taken over and how it was handled. So what I've done is I've broken this down into zones. Because the irony is when you look at the history of this period, this 30, 40 year window, not all Africa was treated the same way. Why? Well, there were different powers that went in. They had different attitudes. There were different types of people that were interacted with. So the result was, it was different. Although in the end, all of Africa would be taken.
For example, start off with North Africa. North Africa was technically part of the Ottoman Empire, going all the way back to the Umayyad Caliphate, the first Muslim empire that was created upon the death of Muhammad. Muslim armies marched across North Africa and claimed the entire strip from Egypt all the way to Morocco. And from about the 7th century all the way up until the 19th century, Muslims controlled that part of the world. But by the 19th century, the 1800s, many of the provinces had semi-autonomy. So meaning, they were part of the Ottoman Empire, but they had their own local government. And the local government paid tribute to Constantinople. So because of this, that meant that every single part could, theoretically, get itself into trouble. Because each government had the right to make its own agreements or own its own treaties, to have trade relations. But at the end of the day, they had to remain loyal to Constantinople. So this meant that they were ripe for plucking. In 1830, France comes in and seizes Algeria. By the 1880s, it would also take Tunisia, and it would begin trying to move into Morocco, because it kind of wanted a monopoly on this part of the Strait of Gibraltar. At around the same time, Italy comes in, conquers Libya. But the example that we're going to focus on is how England got Egypt. Because Egypt is a definite unusual case. Why? Well, we know this, but Egypt actually had, it's kind of like a king. It was called the Khedive. And the Khedives were as a hereditary position. So it passed from father to son, just like kings. And the Khedives had full control over Egypt. So what did this mean? Well, they had the ability to make decisions independent of what Constantinople wanted. By the 19th century, the Khedives are starting to get word of the Industrial Revolution. They're hearing about all of the technological marvels that are appearing in Europe. And they start saying, hey, you know something? We want to modernize too. So, they attempt to do so. They start trying to build new harbors to fit more modern vessels. They want to build roads. They want to build railroads. They want to build a modern army. But the catch is, these things take money. More money than Egypt had. So what do they decide to do? Borrow. Now, by the way, side note, tangent has nothing to do with the class. Way back when the first president of our United States, George Washington, retired, he sent out a message to the American people. And he said one of the deadliest dangers that this nation could face, so deadly that it could destroy us as a country, was debt. If you are in debt, that means you owe someone. And if you owe someone, what can they do to you? They can take. Because if you owe, you're supposed to pay. And if you can't pay, they'll find other ways of getting compensated. By the way, when you decide to become adults and you go out and you try buying a house, do you think you're going to have the cash to buy it outright? No. What are you going to get the house?
A loan.
A loan. And what's that loan called?
Mortgage.
A mortgage. Guess what mortgage documents say? The bank actually owns your house until you pay off the last penny. Because if you don't pay the bank, you know what they'll do? It's called foreclosure. That's the line of law that I deal with. Very messy. The bank will take you to court. They'll sue you. They'll force you to sell the house. And you get nothing. Well, the Khedives wanted these trains and boats and guns and armies and all the rest. But to get it, they put the nation in debt. To pay the loans, the Europeans now control the terms. And you know what the Europeans want? Resources. In particular, they demand cotton. Egyptian cotton, some of the finest cotton on earth. Well, the problem is, there was not enough cotton being produced to pay the loans. So what do the Khedives do? Well, they began telling their people, stop planting food, start planting cotton, so we can pay our debt. I could eat this if I wanted to. I don't know how good my belly would feel afterwards. It's great. All the cotton in the world isn't going to feed little kids. So right off the bat, the Khedives start making decisions that is like a snowball. We want to get new shiny things, so we have to borrow more money. But the moment we borrow more money, we're in more debt, which means we have to put more pressure on our people to produce commodities that have value at their own expense, which means eventually they're going to get to the point where they're not going to like us. Snowball effect. Well, then, at one point, one of the Khedives comes up with a brilliant idea. We can take advantage of the fact that in order for the Europeans to get from Asia to Europe, they have to go all the way around Africa. Look! Look right here. If we could dig a canal deep enough to allow ocean-going vessels to go from the Red Sea to the Mediterranean, that means the European ships no longer have to go all the way around Africa. And you know what we can do once we build this canal? We can put up a toll. We can make money. Do you think they had enough money to dig the canal?
No.
No. So where are they going to get the money to dig the canal to make money?
More loans.
More loans from Europe. Well, it took about 20 years to construct the canal. It would open up in 1869. It would connect the Red Sea to the Mediterranean. But it was built by the French and financed by the French, British, Germans. Egypt did not have enough tax revenue to pay the loans. So this meant all of this debt would have to be paid for by every single penny that was made by the Suez Canal. For 7 years, the canal is operating.
And it costs more and more money to operate the canal. And the government's not making anything. It starts having to take out more loans. And it's just digging itself deeper and deeper and deeper. By the way, this is as smart as taking out new credit cards to borrow money to pay off other credit cards. All you're doing is digging the hole deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper.
Well, it got so bad that by 1876, the Khedive at the time, Ismail Pasha, has to tell the European creditors that his country is bankrupt. There's no more money.
So the creditors are like, we don't care.
So he begins having a fire sale. He, for example, takes all of his shares that he got in the Suez Canal Company, because again, he was the king. He got half ownership. He gave those over to the British, so that way the British could basically take pressure off of him. Other European creditors jumped in, and soon they put so many liens on every single bit of revenue that's coming into the central government that 50 cents out of every dollar that the Egyptians collect in tax revenue is getting paid to the Europeans.
And that's not even covering the interest on their loans.
Soon things start spiraling out of control. And the Europeans are pissed. Because their understanding of banking is our understanding of banking.
If you make a promise, you're going to fulfill the promise. And if you can't fulfill the promise, there are consequences.
It was clear that Pasha had no means of paying back the debt. So what do the Brits and the French do? They contact Constantinople and say, hey, Sultan, do you care if we get rid of him? If we depose him?
But as we're going to see at this point, the Ottoman Empire is so messed up, they don't have the means to say no.
So the Brits decide they're going to have a puppet. And they give the throne to Ismail's son, Tewfik. Because Tewfik promises to do whatever the British want.
The Europeans want money, we're going to get money.
So he uses his power and he increases the taxes by 80%.
This outrages the Egyptian people. They view Tewfik for what he is, a puppet of the Europeans, and they rebel. The new Egyptian army sides with the people and they couped Tewfik. They deposed him. They removed him off the throne. Which triggers a reaction by the British. They send an expeditionary army, land in Egypt, beat the Egyptian army back, and puts Tewfik back on the throne.
Why? Because Tewfik promised to pay the debt.
And as a quid pro quo, Tewfik basically signs over control of the Egyptian economy to England.
Now, to go back to one of the things I talked about last class, what was created was a protectorate.
Egypt becomes a protectorate. It's not a colony. The Egyptians are not actually, the British are not actually there in government offices running government. No. You got Tewfik's government there, the puppet regime.
but Tewfik gives complete monopolistic control over the economy to England. So they make a Bank of Egypt that uses British pounds. The valuation of the pounds are controlled by England. The amount of money in circulation is controlled by England. And if you control the money, you control the country. Now, FYI, England would maintain a protectorate all the way up until 1952. And what did they do? They used their control to block any efforts by the Egyptians to compete with British industries. So, for instance, Tewfik's successor would actually pass a law that said it was illegal for Egyptians to own factories. So there would be no machines. So all of the cotton couldn't be woven into textiles in Egypt. No, the raw cotton had to be put on a boat and shipped to England, where it would be made into cotton. Questions?
When did Egypt start feeling that they could do it themselves? Was it before 1950?
It was like World War II. World War II was kind of a game changer.
Okay.
At that point, a lot of the native people were like, okay, look, you know, you got us here, and then the Germans went in. You know, it was a mess in North Africa. And they started basically saying, yeah, well, what? And then you had the promise of self-determination. You know, there was a promise after World War II that all the colonies would get attention. And Egypt was ignored, which, of course, caused the Egyptians to rise up. And in the end, it was actually Queen Elizabeth who made the decision not to send the British army and then crush Egypt. Just let them go.
Well,
Okay.
Well, thank you.
Other questions? All right. So one last thought before we go on to the next one. What was like for the average Egyptian? They were trapped. Meaning, they could not promote themselves. If you were born a cotton farmer, you would die a cotton farmer because the government wouldn't allow you to do anything else. But at least you weren't brutalized. Unlike what happened in the Congo. Out of all of the examples of the takeover of territory in Africa during the period of new imperialism, there is no more shocking example than what the Belgians did in the Congo. Beginning in the 1880s, lands, this little purple little access point, this is the mouth of the Congo River, which basically sweeps in to the interior. Lands all around the Congo River would be monopolized by the Belgians. But not by the Belgian government, but rather by the King of Belgium, Leopold II. This colony would be his.
What was the difference between the king power and the government?
Belgium had a constitutional monarchy at this time. Belgium was like England. The king was just a figurehead.
Okay.
The country was run by their version of parliament. They had a prime minister, they had different ministers in the cabinet,
okay.
But the king was just kind of there.
Figurehead.
Yeah. Now, the other irony is that Congo, I thought I had the exact size of my notes somewhere.
Sorry.
No. Oh, there we go. Congo is actually 70 times larger than Belgium. Even though it doesn't look that big on a little snapshot of a colored map. But the question is, how did he get it? Well, truth be told, he read books. He read stories about what had taken place during the Age of Exploration. He learned about the tremendous wealth that was made by the kings of old,
with the Spanish conquering the New World, or the Portuguese entering the Asian trade network, or the Dutch when they went in, or the English went in. And he was like, you know something? I kind of want that too. Anyone not want to be rich? You say, if you don't like money, I'll take it. I am an organized 501(c) charity, and I will give you a receipt that you can claim on your taxes. Just give me all your money, and you'll be good. No one ever takes me up on that, surprisingly.
I don't think they know it.
No, I know. So, he gets this plan, and he talks to the parliament, talks to the prime minister, and he's like, you know something? We should get into this colony. But Belgium's a tiny little country. They didn't have a big fleet. They didn't have money to go in and make this type of investment. So Parliament basically said no. Which meant, I get a lot of money. So he would use his own bank account to basically begin gathering acreage. And by the way, if he owns it, where does all the profit go? Can the government tax it? No, because it's his. So, in realizing his colonial dreams, he starts making public declarations that he has humanitarian concerns for the Africans. They're so primitive. They're separated from Jesus. You know, we are so advanced. We are good people. We should go in and we should help them. And by making those arguments, Parliament was like, okay, go have fun. He then hires an agent, Henry Morton Stanley. Stanley was English born. He was a journalist. But he also was like an Indiana Jones type figure. You know, back during this time, you had adventurers that would go into unclaimed parts of the world and they'd write stories that would be published in little books and pamphlets, inspire the imaginations of people. So beginning in 1879, going all the way to 1884, 5 years, Stanley arrives, starts sailing upstream, and starts meeting with chief after chief after chief after chief, and starts making treaties with the locals, who of course could not read the treaties, which were in French. They couldn't even sign their name. They pretty much put X's on everything. Or like a thumbprint or something. But what were in the terms? Well, they basically give over right to all of the land that a tribe holds to the king. Agreement after agreement, tribe by tribe, he starts expanding. And eventually he would take over this massive, massive estate. He then creates a company called the Congo Free State that begins running operations in his estate. And the job was to make money. The mass exportation of rubber and ivory begins. And the administration of these people was brutal. The people basically were enslaved. They were forced to work. Intimidation, torture, mutilation, even mass murder. If they dared say no, they would be shot. They would be burned alive. They would be strangled. They'd be crucified. Not a great picture. But look at how well they were being treated. Look at the men and women and kids.
I know it's not a clear picture, and maybe in your back can't see all the details, but you can see all their ribs. By the way, these people aren't much better off. What's the first physical sign of starvation? You start getting a bloated stomach. And think about the poor elephants. But what ended up happening? Billions of dollars were being made. That was until what was going on was exposed. Beginning in 1898, 99, stories of what was going on began being heard in other parts of Africa. And it inspired the curiosity of a Polish author by the name of Joseph Conrad. Taking the form of a novella, a three-part short adventure story, he tells the tale of his own experiences traveling up to the Congo. See, he hides his identity. He gets a job on one of the ferry boats, a steamship, and pretends to be a member of the crew. But what does he do? Well, wherever it makes a port, stops, he starts talking to people. He starts writing down their stories. He also has cameras hidden secretly and starts taking pictures of what he's seeing. Then in 1902, he ends his job, goes back to Europe, and publishes the stories. And they begin appearing in the newspapers. Well, it shocked so much outrage that the Belgian government launches an investigation. They actually start sending government agents down to the Congo to go see what the heck is going on. And they see it all to be true. There's no sensationalism. Literally, people are being executed, killed, worked to death. Well, the government then basically gives Leopold an offer he cannot refuse. Either give us Congo or you're going to be deposed. So he turned over the colony. And then the government took over and started mitigating all of the abuses that had been perpetrated since the 1880s. But here's the catch. How do you make up for half? By the time the Belgian government took control of it, 50% of the population was dead. 10 million people.
Questions?
What do you have to do with the bodies? Like, where to put them?
Dumped them. Let them be food for the wild animals.
10 million people died?
Mass graves, throw them in the river. To be honest with you, do you think the people even had energy to bury him? Other questions? So given the choice, I would have rather been an Egyptian than a Congolese. Then the last example I got for you is what took place down in South Africa. Now, South Africa, it was also a weird dynamic situation. Because on one hand, it is one of the richest parts of the entire continent. South Africa is full of fertile pastures, rich farmland. The best farming acreage on the entire continent. South Africa is often referred to as the breadbasket of Africa. While simultaneously, it's rich in natural resources.
There's coal. There's iron. There's gold. There's diamonds. There's copper. So, talking about billions of dollars in wealth, there you go. But, who owned the land? Whites, who referred to themselves as Boers. Although the Europeans often referred to them as Afrikaners. Going back in time, after the Portuguese fell and the Dutch came in, pushing into Asia, they would begin making small stopping points in the southern point of Africa that would eventually grow to become colonies. By the 18th century, there were tens and hundreds of thousands of Dutch settlers. FYI, Boer is Dutch for farmer. So, they took possession of the land and they started making big farms, estates. I'm going to say plantation, but they didn't have slaves. Everything is going great. Nothing but growth, nothing but expansion, nothing but money. Until 1806, and Napoleon declares war on the European continent. And the Netherlands were so terrified that Napoleon was going to conquer them, because he did. And the moment Napoleon conquered them, technically South Africa, which was literally a gold mine, would become his. So before Napoleon's armies invaded the Dutch country, the Netherlands turned ownership of South Africa over to Britain. So, beginning in 1806, it becomes British property. Once the Napoleonic Wars were settled, give or take the 1820s, 1830s, the Brits are assessing what they have possession of, and they realize how awkward it is having a colony full of Dutch people. So, what they want is they want Anglicanization to occur. Meaning, they want the Dutch to stop speaking in Dutch, they want them to start speaking in English. They want English words being used. They want English institutions, English common law, all being superimposed upon South Africa. Well, ironically, when the British began doing it, they not only started pissing off the Afrikaners, but there were also natives that were there that the Afrikaners got along great with. And the natives didn't like this idea of Anglicanization either. So they began to push back. Joining the Afrikaners were powerful tribes, the Shona, the Nubela, and of course the most famous, the Zulu. Warrior cultures, fierce fighters, aimed at protecting their ancestral homes. Wars actually commenced. The worst was the Anglo-Zulu War of 1879. The Brits would win, but at huge costs. A couple hundred thousand Zulu warriors and tens of thousands of British soldiers would lose their lives. And if that wasn't enough, the British would fight not one but two wars against the Boers. And the Boers almost won.
Now, FYI, one of the most amazing, bizarre consequences of the Boer Wars was when the Second Boer War came to an end in 1902, the British actually started questioning their strength, their ability to control one-eighth of the world. Which, of course, would kind of cause them to be a little reactionary against the Germans and one of the factors that would lead to World War I. But after so much bloodshed, after so much violence, the Brits basically decide the best way to maintain profitability with South Africa is basically to give full control over to, well, the people closest to us. And in 1910, they would make a pact with the Afrikaners, and they would give to them full control over South Africa. This would give rise to the creation of what became known as the Union of South Africa. The Brits basically would unify all of their four territories into a centralized state. The governing body of South Africa would have full autonomy, but they remained allied with the British Empire. So they weren't governed by England, but they were part of the empire through an alliance. But by doing so, this agreement allowed for the minority population, the Afrikaners, to control the majority population, the native peoples. How? Through the passage of law. In order to vote, voting qualifications would be based on land ownership. To own land, you had to have title over the land. And the people who had title over the land traced their origins all the way back to the arrival of the Dutch. Because the tribes don't own land, the tribes share land communally. So because the natives were not allowed to vote, the government, democratically, had elections. And amazingly, all the people who won office were Afrikaners. And then they started passing laws legally that basically gave more and more and more rights to the Afrikaners. Because after all, they're the only ones who vote. And it would get so bad that by the 1940s, an apartheid system would be created, in which the white elites would control a segregated society. Public facilities, social events, housing, jobs, schools, everything was segregated. All of the money went to the whites only stuff, and everything was left to the blacks, the natives. And how long would it last? I'm sure you remember it. The fall of apartheid in South Africa. Do you remember what company was most responsible for it?
No.
It was Coca-Cola.
That's right, it was.
Yeah, it was Coca-Cola.
Because that's where they started their company for World War I or II.
Yeah, they were operating down there, I think in World War II, to help produce more to get it sold globally, right? Yeah, and then in the early 1980s, Coca-Cola was like, we're going to pull out our factory. We're not going to do business here if you maintain apartheid. And the moment Coca-Cola did it, all of the other companies started falling like dominoes.
Questions?
Why were the Portuguese still prominent as a race? To this day, they have, well, at least in America, statuses known as Cape Verdean Portuguese. Why is that still a status? Do you know?
I don't.
There's a pocket of people from Cape Verde who live in Fall River.
Yeah. There's a huge Portuguese community down there. I don't know their history.
Okay.
So I'm not even going to take a guess at it.
I'm sure. I'm just enough, you know, enough.
Yeah, I do know some things, but I don't know everything.
It's just weird.
I wish I could. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's just weird, you know.
Well, it's like in my hometown in Northbridge, there was a huge Armenian pocket down there, so.
Oh.
All right, any other questions on this? All right, let's start talking about the next thing. And we'll get a little bit, and then we'll call a class for vacation.
Well, if the Europeans are carving up Africa, obviously they would have an impact on what was right next door, the Middle East. Because as they took away chunks out of North Africa, all of that territorial loss was impacting the Ottoman Empire.
And when we last talked about them, they began their period of decline because of the pressure that was put on by the Europeans. Now, there are many people that give reasons why it occurred.
But most historians agree what happened to the Ottomans could have been avoidable if they had better leadership. Going back to Mehmed II, like we said, when he retreated from public and started staying in his palace and started living the good life, successor after successor after successor began doing that, and they were not paying attention to what was going on in their empire. So the viziers started getting corrupt. The janissaries started getting corrupt. The provincial governors started getting corrupt. And all the while, the Sultan had no idea what was going on. But by the 19th century, the economic system in the world began to change because of the Industrial Revolution. Ottomans produced goods by hand. They had highly skilled artisans and craftsmen. And if you do something by hand, it takes lots of time. And those hours have value to them, which increases the cost of things. Whereas by the 1760s, 70s, 80s, into the 1800s, in England, they've mechanized the weaving process. You have steam-powered engines fueling these textile machines, putting out yards and yards and yards of cloth in a matter of seconds. And these cheaply made goods began flooding the marketplaces of the empire. And they couldn't compete. Riots broke out. Religious tensions began to erupt. And it was like everything was being ripped apart.
Well, sure, the Ottoman Empire was once the scourge of Europe
in the 16th and 17th centuries. But by the 19th century, all of this land that they can't control, let's start scooping it out. And how do they do it? Incrementally. They could not take it all at once. So, little bit, little bit, little bit, little bit, little bit. Death by a thousand cuts. They began targeting the border regions. And literally it began after the Siege of Vienna. in 1683, beginning with the Austrians. Once the Ottomans could no longer come into Austria, they began pushing back, starting to go down into the Balkans. They began conquering Slovenia, Croatia, parts of Romania. All of this region here in purple. And the Ottomans couldn't stop them. The Russians too. Coming down through this part of the world known as the Caucasus. At one point, the Ottomans controlled even the Crimea in modern Ukraine. But beginning with the reign of Peter the Great, the Russians began marching south. Heck, in total, I thought I had it in here somewhere. I think they fought like 20 wars between one another. And usually the Russians were on the winning side. And by the way, why did Peter the Great start it? Well, he wanted to control the northern region of the Black Sea because he dreamed of having a freshwater port so he could sail Russian ships into the Mediterranean and engage in global commerce. But, coincidentally, the greatest Russian conqueror was actually Catherine the Great. During her reign, she tripled the size of the Russian Empire, conquered all of Siberia. It was during her reign that the Russians seized Alaska. And there were Russians as far south on the Pacific coast as Northern California. She finished the conquest of the Caucasus. That's the reason why this was no longer green. But unlike the Austrians, the Russians were also part of the Orthodox faith. So as the Russians were winning, they inspired the Christian peoples in the Baltics to begin independence movements. The first would be the Serbs in 1804, but they would get crushed. Then in the 1820s, the Greeks would rebel. And by the 1830s, they would win their independence. Then in 1867, Serbia rebelled again, won their independence. And soon the Serbs and the Greeks began helping everybody, resulting eventually in the Montenegrins, the Albanians, the Bulgarians, all to break away, declaring their independence. And FYI, by the eve of World War I, this little bit of green was all that the Ottomans had left in Europe. So, how could you survive, imperially speaking, when you're losing acres by the thousands? And this is where we're going to finish, because I'm going to finish early. They just happen to have so much land. That's ultimately what allowed them to survive all the way into the 20th century. Barely. But remember when I said how the Europeans made a deal not to go to war with one another in Africa? Well, that deal was based on an agreement that they made with the Ottoman Empire, or over the Ottoman Empire. The Brits, eventually the Germans, the Russians, the French, they all began making investments in the Ottoman Empire. And they started getting leverage over the Sultanate. And the last thing they wanted to do was to have any of them win. So they begin triangulating. The Brits don't want the Russians to get control, so the Brits will make a deal with the French. Or the French don't want the Germans to get control, so they'll make a deal with the Austrians. So even though we're going to see the Empire would make it to and just beyond the end of World War I, it really was a shell of itself by that point, propped up by European money. Two more clicks after this, and then we're done. But I'm not saying the Ottomans were blind to it. There was actually attempts. There were people in the empire that realized what was going on. They realized how close they were to collapse. And they would attempt to initiate reforms, as we're going to see when we come back from break. But the problem is if you're going to make a change, the people in charge are going to lose their power, their influence. And they're not going to support it. Not trying to be political, but I just thought of a great analogy. If you're paying attention to what's going on in our country. On Tuesday night, the President of the United States gave a speech before a joint session of Congress, in which he's talking about all the stuff that he's happy that he's doing. And by the way, every president does that. But if you were paying attention, particularly when he's talking about like DOGE and how much money, our taxpayer money, is being wasted, you can tell who benefits the most by that corruption. If you watched it, you should have noticed all of the Democrats were sitting down in their seats, holding their little paddles, not clapping for anything. Why would any elected official in our country want waste? Why would any elected official in our country, in DRI, whatever party they are, why would they want our taxpayer money being wasted? Who were the people that were applauding to the expose of the corruption? Probably not the people who were part of the corruption. But who are the people sitting on their hands? We live in crazy times. So do you think the Democrats are going to work with the Republicans to cut our expenses, to eliminate our debt, to lower our tax burden so we can keep more of our money? No. Same thing in the Ottoman Empire. So even though they knew they needed to do something, the people that could have helped didn't want anything to do it. And what may happen to Trump's efforts, what also happens at times is even if you're pushing for reforms, nobody can agree on which reforms to implement. So it may be that this DOGE thing is a fly-by-night, you know, meteorite streaking across the sky. It's very possible. That happens more often than not, historically speaking. But the Ottoman Empire, when they had a chance to do something about it, they couldn't even agree what needed to be done. This is why they're going to die. And we'll deal with that when we come back from break. Now, three simple requests. Request number one, if you are going somewhere, have fun. If you are just going home, give mom and dad a hug and tell them thank you. But if you're sitting around doing nothing, get your paper done. Have a good break.